In part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting the Beaux-Arts Trio's Golden Anniversary on Saturday, October 9th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Sinfonia da Camera joins the Beaux-Arts Trio as they celebrate 50 years of performing. For more information, call 333-6280.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with Norman Finkelstein from DePaul University. He's professor of political science there. And he's someone among people who follow very closely at politics in the Middle East, someone who is very well known and also a very controversial figure for his writing about the policies of the government Israel and about the Holocaust. He is the author of a number of books, including The Rise and Fall of Palestine, a personal account of the Intifada years based on some of his experiences living with Palestinian people on the occupied territories, The Nation on a Nation of Trial, the Goldhagen Thesis and Historical Truth, a book that takes on what was a very popular, well-received kind of book that was written a few years ago, making the argument that all of the German people were somehow complicit in the Holocaust, and his most recent, The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, that makes the argument that institutions, organizations, individuals have used Jewish suffering for political and financial gain. He has certainly many supporters and also many, perhaps more, detractors. And I think it's fair to say that the criticism of him and his work has been plain right, downright out and out vicious over the years. He has taught, in addition to teaching now at DePaul, he's been at Hunter College, at New York University, at Brooklyn College. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments, of course, are welcome as always. We just ask people to try to be brief in their comments so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving along. But of course, anybody listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, in fact, if you were listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Finkelstein, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine.
Thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it. You know, on this program over the years, we have tried to follow up on listener requests when people have asked for particular topics or guests. And there has been a very long-standing request from listener to have you on the program. And it was renewed again, well, now probably maybe 3 weeks ago when we were had a guest here on the program. We were talking about anti-Semitism. And maybe I might start there and ask you if you can talk a little bit about anti-Semitism today, particularly whether or not it is somehow different, because there are people, and this particular guest that we had on are among them, who do make the argument that there has been some sort of fundamental change, not that anti-Semitism is new, but that there has been some sort of fundamental change in its nature, and that in fact now we're seeing something that has certainly been called the new anti-Semitism.
Well, the first point to make, and it happens, this is not intended to toot my own horn, just as a matter of information. I've just completed a book on the topic. The first point to make is roughly about every 15 years, the same Jewish organizations and their supporters make the claim about a new anti-Semitism. So if you go back to 1974, there was a book by the head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, named Arnold Foster, and his colleague Benjamin Epstein. The title of the book was The New Anti-Semitism. You then go to 1982, and the head of the ADL at that time was a fellow named Nathan Perlmutter, and his wife Ruth Ann Perlmutter. They put out a book called The Real Anti-Semitism. The theme was, there's a new anti-Semitism. And now we have the third round of this media-orchestrated extravaganza about a new anti-Semitism. These orchestrated campaigns have little to do, in fact, they have nothing to do with anti-Semitism, and they have everything to do with deflecting criticism of Israel. So in 1974, it was at the time of the Arab oil boycott, and pressure was put on Israel to withdraw its troops from the Egyptian-occupied Sinai. That was after the October 1973 war. Pressure was put on Israel to withdraw. They organized the new anti-Semitism. And in 1982, when pressure was put on Israel to recognize the PLO and accept a two-state settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict, they again brought out the new anti-Semitism production, and they're doing the same thing again now because of pressures on Israel due to the brutal repression of the Second Intifada. So I think the bottom line is, as I said a moment ago, these campaigns have nothing to do with new anti-Semitism and have everything to do with immunizing Israel from criticism.
That is, if we reduce the essential arguments, I think, that you've made in a lot of your work and that have drawn so much criticism from the American Jewish community, as I understand it, it would be that. It would be that discussion, in some cases, discussion of anti-Semitism or discussion of the Holocaust is intended to deflect criticism from the government of Israel vis-a-vis its treatment of the Palestinians.
Well, I think that's basically correct, and also I would want to amend the statement you made a moment ago. I can't really judge what American Jews generally thought of my work. I suspect very few have read it. It's American Jewish organizations which object to the work because I have rather unpleasant things to say about American Jewish organizations and so-called American Jewish leaders. But I think it's a mistake to assume that one necessarily represents the other. If you take the case, for example, of the last war against Iraq, American Jewish opinion, namely American Jews generally, they were pretty much in line with American public opinion as a whole. It was about, your estimate was about 59 or 57% of Americans supported the war in Iraq, and it was roughly the same, maybe a slight bit less among American Jews generally. However, when you get to American Jewish organizations, there the support for the war was roughly about 100 to 105%. They weren't just supporting it, they were urging it on, acting at Israel's behest. So I think there's a certain danger in extrapolating from what American Jewish organizations believe and American Jewish so-called leaders believe, extrapolating from that to the opinion of American Jews generally. I'm an old-fashioned First Amendment fundamentalist, a great admirer of John Stuart Mill on liberty and all that sort of stuff. And so I post on my website every letter I receive, every email I receive regarding my writing. And if you look at the website, you'll see, yeah, there are some pretty vicious letters there. But on the whole, I think the sentiments of my readers, many of whom are Jewish, are quite positive.
Well, indeed, I have looked at some of those, although you would be in a position to know if you'd counted up how many were basically supportive.
I don't count up as a matter of record.
Okay. I would say only you would know how it runs, whether there's more on one side or on the other side. Some of your critics have been critical of your work because they would say that it provides ammunition for people on the extreme right, Holocaust deniers, and so forth. Just to be clear for people who are listening,
it would be rather difficult, either as a point of personal biography or as a point of my own writing, to find any evidence there of Holocaust denial. That's quite preposterous. I'm not blaming you, of course. Those are the claims of the usual professional smearers and slanderers in the ADL, the so-called Anti-Defamation League, which specializes in defamation of character. That's the kinds of slanders and smears they exploit. But it's impossible to find Holocaust denial in the book. It's totally ludicrous. The whole point of my book is to affirm the Nazi Holocaust and to affirm it against those who cheaply, meretriciously exploit it for political and financial gain. That's not Holocaust denial. The real Holocaust deniers in the world today are the American Jewish organizations, because they're the ones who go around saying there are 1 million Holocaust survivors, 1.5 million Holocaust survivors. I'll let your audience use a moment's reflection. How is it possible 60 years after World War II for there to be 1.5 million Holocaust survivors? But that's what they claim. If you claim that there are 1.5 million Holocaust survivors, then you're a Holocaust denier. Because as my late mother used to say, and she was a Holocaust survivor, she was in the Warsaw Ghetto, she was in the Warsaw Ghetto until the uprising, and then was in a Majdanek concentration camp, and then in 2 slave labor camps. She was an authentic survivor. And she used to say, as everybody walked around claiming they were Holocaust survivors, now they do it mostly for getting so-called Holocaust reparations, which is another racket. My late mother used to say, if everybody who claims to be a Holocaust survivor actually is one, who did Hitler kill? I'm not the Holocaust denier. They've turned the Nazi Holocaust into a financial shakedown to get what they call Holocaust reparations. And in order to get the reparations, they inflate the figures of the numbers of people who survived. Well, if you keep inflating the figure for the number who survived, you end up deflating the figure of the number who were killed. They're the Holocaust deniers, not me.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Norman Finkelstein. He's assistant professor of political science at DePaul University and has written quite a lot about the politics in the Middle East, but really specifically the conflict between Palestinians and the government of Israel. He's also written the book, the most recent. It's entitled The Holocaust Industry, making in further depth some of the points that he's already made here. It is now available in paperback. It's published by Verso. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can certainly find it. Questions and comments are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Do I have it also correct that this book that we've talked about, The Holocaust Industry and the controversy generated by it, it essentially cost you your job at Hunter College?
Academia is a very peculiar place. Henry Kissinger, probably the only true statement he ever made in his life, was he once, reflecting on his own experience at Harvard, he said, the battles are so vicious because the stakes are so puny. Mm. And that's really what academia is about. You know, you lose friends over misspelling a colleague's name in a footnote. So I say that all by way of wanting to be clear that it's very hard in academic life to distinguish where principle ends and ego begins. I would like to be able to say it was all politics that cost me my job at Hunter. I would say it was partly, that I don't doubt. But I also think there's the usual the petty academic envy and the petty academic jealousy. For those of your listeners who have any illusions about academia, allow me to dispel them. Academia has very little to do with intellectual pursuit and has a lot to do with ego aggrandizement.
Well, this is, after all, a university community. I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who are attached to the university. They can make that judgment
sure,
for themselves.
I'm sure they're nodding their head.
Back to for a moment to the Holocaust industry, and I guess I'm just interested in because of your criticisms of the ways in which you feel that the Holocaust has been used. How does one arrive at an appropriate kind of way to talk about it that on the one hand acknowledges it, as you have, and again, you certainly are not denying the Holocaust, but on the other hand, not exploiting it? How does one walk that line?
Well, you know, those are both, you know, those are, I'm not sure if this is the right way to phrase it, and I think that's a perfectly fair question. I guess I have to start out by saying I don't want to claim to be an arbiter on these questions. I don't have, you know, such a refined aesthetic sensibility that I can claim or I can pretend to claim to know where it's just right and where it crosses the line and becomes vulgar, gross, meretricious, and, you know, cheap. I don't think I have the capacity for that, and even if I did have a personal capacity, it still becomes a little bit arrogant for me to be the arbiter of those questions. As I said at the very end of my book, my own view is that the Nazi Holocaust now, its physical dimension has to be reduced, which is simply a fancy way of saying it's too much already. There are now more Holocaust museums in the United States than there are Burger Kings. And at the current rate, there'll soon be more Holocaust museums than McDonald's. It's enough already. The point's been made. It's time now to open up our hearts and our minds to the sufferings of other peoples, not just Jews. So its physical dimension, in my view, it's time to reduce it. And its moral dimension needs to be expanded, which is simply a fancy way of saying, it's enough already with Jews, Jews, Jews. The way my parents imparted to me the lessons of the Nazi Holocaust, it was about human suffering generally. And they never sought, never tried, never did differentiate the suffering they experienced, they endured, from the sufferings of other people. Rather, the contrary. They always used their suffering as a point of departure for reaching out and trying to understand the suffering of others. The mantra of the Holocaust industry in the United States is, rather than reaching out, the mantra is, do not compare. That is to say, oh yes, they're suffering, oh yes, that's terrible, but it doesn't compare to our suffering. Never to compare. Ours is unique, ours is special, ours surpasses all others. Nothing in the history of humankind has ever approached the suffering that we endured. I think that's just a form, it's a politically loaded form of ethnic aggrandizement. I think it's time to morally expand the meaning of the Nazi Holocaust. So those would be my two caveats. Physical dimension reduced, enough already with the museums, and not to mention movies, books, etc., and to morally expand it.
You don't think that the attention that has been paid to the Holocaust already in terms of popular culture, in terms of museums, that somehow that for people is a starting point for them to consider other cases of genocide in the 20th century?
I wish it were. I know growing up in my own home it was, but I don't think that's the way it's projected. I think the starting point is, regrettably, it's the ending point. It's that nobody has suffered like the Jews. Do not compare. Elie Wiesel is always wheeled out, and with his long face and anguished heart and cinematic eyes, he always says, oh, do not compare. I beg your pardon. I think you should compare. Otherwise, if you don't want to compare, what's the point of it? What are you going to learn from it? If you simply lift it out of history and say, as Elie Wiesel likes to say, that you can't understand it, there are no words for it, you're entering a zone of darkness, you can't speak about it. That's one of his favorite lines, that imbecile. You can't speak about it. Well, if you can't speak about it, why are you charging $25,000 a lecture? What are you talking about if you can't speak about it? He says the only thing we can do before the Nazi Holocaust is silence. Well, if silence is the only answer, why are you charging $25,000 a lecture? And what are you going to learn from silence? I mean, this is sheer nonsense. It's ethnic solipsism on a cosmic scale.
We have some callers here. Let's bring them into the conversation. We'll start with someone in Champaign and on line number one.
Hello. Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm an American Jewish woman listening to this show because I always seek to augment my understanding of the Jewish experience with many perspectives. So I started listening to this show with a very open mind. But so I'm just going to react from a personal point of view. First of all, my mother-in-law was an Auschwitz survivor. She's now deceased, had a tattoo on her arm. She never got a cent from anybody. And I think that you need to acknowledge that there's many survivors out there who did not get reparations, did not seek reparations, were not invited to get reparations, and when there was that occasional news flurry of reparations are available, that the process of obtaining or seeking that was so arduous as to be off-putting. So that's another
point. I hope the caller stays on. Please I'm asking the caller not to hang up
on
me.
I want to make another point. You know, it's funny you talk about egoism in academia, because I'm finding that a lot of your statements or opinions, which you're entitled to, but they're not based on fact, because, mm-hmm. you know, I work in a high school. I work in a local high school with young people who really know nothing about the Holocaust, and I've taken a personal interest in how they're taught it by bringing in authentic survivors so that they just get a personalized perspective, and it is very much with the goal of teaching them that this can happen anywhere, and in this particular case, that it's white people against white people, because so much of young people's understanding of, you know, warring factions are along racial lines and so forth. So it is very much with the idea of teaching about intolerance and really how easily these things can happen. And I went to the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, and it was very much about simply using the Holocaust as a starting point to teach about discrimination, racism, and they brought in examples from all over the world. So I really find offensive your broad brushstroke of anybody who talks about the Holocaust is doing a poor me number, because, you know, I really find that offensive, and I just simply think it's not true. And, you know, there might be some cases of that, but I don't find educators like Elie Wiesel and people like that out there doing poor me, poor me. And I think you don't show respect for the true educational goals that a lot of Jewish people are trying to put out there in terms of understanding the suffering of people around the world. I think you are not really acknowledging that properly.
Okay, may I respond?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, first of all, I genuinely welcome the phone call from your listener, because I can understand that things I say offend people, but I think the response was very lucid and calm, which I deeply appreciate. Regarding the first point, I totally agree. I think many survivors of the Nazi Holocaust didn't get any money. My late mother, as I said, she survived the Warsaw Ghetto, the uprising, Majdanek concentration camp, and two slave labor camps. She got $3,000. That was the total she received. I write about it in the book. Mm-hmm. The question is, nobody disputes, it's not a matter of dispute, that the German government has paid out since the 1950s, has paid out between $60 and $80 billion in Holocaust reparations. That we know for certain. We also have reasonable ballpark figures for the number of people that survived the Nazi Holocaust. The figure usually given by people like respected historians like Henry Friedlander, Raoul Hilberg, they all give roughly the same figure. About 100,000 Jews survived the death camps, the labor camps, the ghettos. 100,000 in May 1945. And now the question is, if the Germans gave out between $60 and $80 billion, which nobody disputes, and there were only about 100,000 survivors, and many of those, like this caller's mother-in-law and like my late mother, never received any money, where did the money go? And that's what half of my book is about. It's about how the American Jewish organizations, in the name of the survivors, collected for themselves billions of dollars. That's the shakedown racket. Mm-hmm. They didn't just shake down the European governments. They didn't just shake down the Swiss banks, the French banks, and so forth. They didn't just shake down the governments. That's half the story. The other half is they shook down the survivors. They took the money in the name of the survivors, and the survivors never got anything. Anyone who follows the Jewish press, I don't know if your caller does, would know that there's a story literally every week about the efforts of the Holocaust survivors, the real ones, to get money from these organizations which collected in their name and now are keeping the money for themselves. Or for what they call Holocaust education. So I totally agree. That's what half of my book is about, mm-hmm. the Holocaust industry shakedown of the survivors. Regarding the second question, namely how the Nazi Holocaust is taught, I don't want to take, you know, I want to give other callers a chance. I want to just say briefly that the caller began by saying that her high school students know next to nothing about the Holocaust, or young people, she said. The fact of the matter is young people know next to nothing about anything. That's simply the state of our education. But if you were to ask what they know anything about, my experience, and I've been teaching now for 30 years, my experience is just about the only historical event they have any knowledge of is the Nazi Holocaust. They certainly know more about the Nazi Holocaust than they do about the American Civil War, let alone the American Revolution. So I don't think it's accurate to say that somehow they have been deprived or denied knowledge of the Nazi Holocaust as against other historical events. Relatively speaking, let me tell you a simple fact, or allow me to present a simple fact. You ask any typical high school student how many Jews died during World War II, I would say most would know 6 million, or something like 6 million. Ask them how many Southeast Asians died during the war in Vietnam, or war in Southeast Asia. How many of them would know 3 to 4 million Vietnamese were killed? I'd say the answer is probably close to zero. Incidentally, they're teachers as well. Okay.
Well, I do have another caller, but I just wanted to give the caller here with us an opportunity if she wanted to do a quick follow-up.
But you're missing my other point, which is that I think that you're not acknowledging that the way the Holocaust is being treated by educators is not just, everyone knows that happened, everyone knows the 6 million figure, but that's not what I want people to understand. I want people to understand how these events could be replicated in today's life and how they are being replicated all over the globe.
I totally agree.
I think that Jewish educators are, you know, the ones that I know and certainly that I've talked to are trying to get that message across, and that your statements, enough already with the Holocaust museums and so forth, isn't acknowledging the efforts, including the one in Washington, of not just making it about Jews, but trying to get across that this can happen anywhere. I think that they've all done that, and I think that it hasn't been about, you know, pity us, poor me.
I think they do that selectively. I'll give you an example. During the build-up to the war in Iraq, all of a sudden, all of the Jewish organizations start to say, Saddam is like Hitler. We have to stop him now. It's appeasement. If you read Bob Woodward's book, the last book on Iraq, I can't recall the title right now, it just slipped my mind. He has this dramatic scene of how Elie Wiesel goes to the White House. He's talking to Condoleezza Rice, and he goes into Bush's office, and he tells him how we have to attack Iraq, how we have to go after Iraq. Saddam is Hitler. Yeah, they use it for expanding its meaning. Mm-hmm. They expand its meaning in ways which are useful to the United States and Israel.
I appreciate that you bring out how, you know, I appreciate that you're looking at things critically, because I think that we need that type of information to make our own judgments. But I also think that if, as an educator, what I would appreciate is if you also differentiate between which American Jewish organizations are doing what, so that we have a better understanding. I appreciate that you differentiate between American Jewish organizations and American Jewish people, and research along those lines and the histories of these organizations and what they're doing, I think is good critical thinking. So I'll hang up now. Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you. And let me tell you, I always enjoy having a person who disagrees with me and we can talk. Terrific.
We are a bit past the midpoint here. We have some other callers we'll get on to, but I do, again, want to reintroduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in here in the last 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. Our guest for the program is Norman Finkelstein. He's professor of political science at DePaul University. He has also taught at Hunter College, New York University, Brooklyn College. He's written a lot about Israel and its policies in the occupied territories and in regard to the Palestinians. And also, we've been talking here mostly about his most recent book, which is titled The Holocaust Industry, the subtitle Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. It's now available in paperback edition and is a book that makes this fundamental argument that we have been discussing, that He argues that, individuals, institutions, organizations have used Jewish suffering and the Holocaust for both political and financial gain. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have next up caller in Belgium, that is near Danville, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. To get off the subject for just a half a second here, nice to hear you again, Mr. Inge.
Thank you.
And Mr. Brighton did a fabulous job. Really enjoyed his 2 weeks. To the point I'd like to get to with the guest you have, can you expound on the relationship between this administration and the Sharon government? There seems to be something very close going on here involved with Iraq and with the Palestinian Intifada. Thank you very much. I'll listen.
All right.
Well, you know, on the one hand, I am not, I don't find conspiracy theories appealing, but on the other hand, I also find unappealing the efforts to dismiss every time, every kind of argument that people don't like as the conspiracy theory. So I'm both anti and pro conspiracy theories, or I'm neutral. Let's put it this way, I'm neutral on conspiracy theories. On the relationship between the U.S. government and Israel, certainly since the United States exploited the events of 9/11 to launch what they call an international war on terrorism, at that point there was a major confluence of interests between the United States and Israel to the point that they now are virtually indistinguishable one from the other. They both use the war on terrorism to carry out, you know, policies which have very little to do with terrorism, but have a lot to do with their long-term political agendas. So I don't think it's so much that Israel, or in this case, the tail is wagging the dog. Israel is telling the United States what to do. I don't believe there's a cabal of, you know, Jewish neoconservatives who are shaping Israel, American policy to serve Israel's interests. I think there's a confluence of interest between the United States and Israel, or I should say there's a confluence of ideological exploitation between the United States and Israel, each of which pursues its own individual agenda, and that agenda often overlaps. The United States wanted for a long time, wanted to occupy Iraq. They found their pretext. And Israel was, you know, happy to go along with that. I don't think Israel, incidentally, was particularly concerned about Iraq. Iraq posed exactly zero security threat to anyone in the region, let alone to the United States or to Israel. But Israel was wanted to deal another devastating blow to the Arab world, to bring it to its knees, to psychologically shatter it, with the most immediate purpose being to force a settlement in the Palestinians, hoping they would be so psychologically devastated by the quote-unquote shock and awe of the second war that they would concede. And then Israel was also hoping that the destruction of Iraq would be used as a stepping stone to attacking Iran and Syria. As it happened, the aftermath of the war didn't go as planned, and Iran and Syria seem to be, though there's now talk again about attacking Iran, seem to be off the agenda. But I don't think we have a case here of wire pullers behind the curtain. There's a confluence of interests. There's a common ideological agenda or a common exploitation of an ideological theme, this war on terrorism. Beyond that, it's pretty much, I think, business as usual.
All right, let's go to Chicago next, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to repeat the gentleman from Belgium. Welcome back, Mr. Inge, and Mr. Brighton did do a good job. I have a comment and a question. One is that I agree with your analysis of when claims of the new anti-Semitism comes out, because earlier this year there were cries of a new anti-Semitism because of a poll taken in Europe where 72% said that Israel was the greatest danger to world security. But nobody talked about the fact that the poll was taken a week after Israel had bombed the Syrian border and Syria had gone to the UN and called a special session of the Security Council, which makes that poll very logical. But instead, no one mentioned that, and everyone kept screaming the new anti-Semitism. And I don't know who puts that into motion, but I've noticed that our news media doesn't analyze anything, and they simply repeat. And so they were all repeating the new anti-Semitism. My question is this. A gentleman, I can't remember his last name, he wrote the book The American Axis. He has said
American
that
what?
The American Axis.
Axis, uh-huh.
Uh-huh. He had said that Preston Bush was the banker to the Nazis, and there's no reason to doubt his documentation. What I find puzzling is that given the Bush's long-standing relationship with Israel, why hasn't anyone asked for reparations from the Bush family? And, in fact, no one ever discusses that. And I would have thought that especially those in, as you call it, the Holocaust industry would have been attacked that aspect of the Bush legacy.
Well, I don't know the details on Prescott Bush and the Nazis. There is a new book that just came out in Germany called America and the Holocaust by a woman named Eva Schweitzer. And there were excerpts, not excerpts, it was an article on her book in the British Guardian. And apparently there were a considerable financial relationship. There was a considerable financial relationship between Bush's grandfather, or George Bush Sr.'s father, Prescott Bush, and the Nazis. But I don't want to... I'm one of those old-fashioned people who believes you should know facts before you speak, and I've not read Eva Schweitzer's book, so I don't want to comment on it. On the second question, namely, why didn't go after Prescott Bush? Well, there's a more interesting, I think, a more interesting question than that. Namely, most of your listeners will have remembered the big to-do over the Swiss banks and how the Swiss banks kept the money of Holocaust survivors after the war and so on and so forth. And it made a huge, there was a huge hue and cry in the press. But there were two footnotes to that story which never get reported. Number one, it is true that Jews between 1933 and 45, during the Hitler years, it is true that Jews in Eastern Europe did, to protect their money, they, not just Eastern Europe, Central Europe as well, to protect their money, they did deposit it in Swiss banks. But you have to remember that Switzerland is in Europe, and there was the fear that Switzerland would be overrun by the Nazis. And so a lot of the money was deposited not in Swiss banks. It was deposited in American banks. And the big question is, what happened to that money? Now, we imposed on Switzerland a $700 million audit of all of its accounts in the banks. You know, it was the largest audit in the history of the world, of $700 million. There's no audit ever imposed on American banks. Nobody knows what ever happened to the money that was deposited here. We, meaning American Jewish organizations and the U.S. government, held Switzerland to one standard, but didn't apply the standard to itself. That's one footnote. The second footnote is, you know where a large amount of money went? It went to Jewish banks in Palestine, because Jews thought that they were going to emigrate there, or for emotional reasons, deposited their money there. What happened to the money in the Israeli banks? Well, we know now there was a lot of money deposited there. In fact, probably more than was deposited in the Swiss banks. And here's the footnote. You can go look at your website for Haaretz, because Israel's main newspaper has a Haaretz. Has a story about it roughly every 2 weeks. The Israeli banks won't give back the money. Switzerland is held to one standard, and Israel and the United States, which led this international hue and cry against Switzerland, they hold themselves to an altogether different standard, a zero standard.
But what you're saying is basically that the American Jewish organizations are complicit in that because they've...
Of course they're complicit in it, because they looked for... they know that without the backing of the U.S. government, they can't do anything. And so the U.S. government, Clinton administration, and the Clinton administration basically did it for financial reasons. One of, if not the leading contributor to the Clinton campaign and to the Democratic National Committee, one of, if not the leading, was Edgar Bronfman, who's the head of the World Jewish Congress. So it was a kind of payoff for what's called in the Jewish literature, Jewish money, the Jewish contributions to the Democratic National Committee and to the Clinton campaign in particular. The U.S. government went along with the shakedown of the Swiss banks. Our banks.
All right. Let's go on to another caller. Next in line is Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. For some time now, I've been thinking about Israel, and I think that the Israelis are doing the same thing to the Palestinians. They're perpetrating a Holocaust on the Palestinians, just as Hitler did the Holocaust on the Jews. And the Israelis want the Palestinians out of there so they can take over. And so I just feel very upset about that.
I don't think everything has to be the Nazi Holocaust to be horrible. What Israel is doing to the Palestinians is terrible. It's awful. And at that point, to my thinking, it's more useful to simply describe what's going on and let people use their moral judgments about whether what's going on deserves to be condemned and whether we should use all our, mobilize all of our efforts to prevent it. The systematic destruction, literally, this is not a metaphor, the systematic destruction of Palestinian life, from the confiscation of the lands to the
right.
bulldozing of the homes,
right.
to the systematic torture of Palestinian detainees,
right.
All of those things ought to be condemned. And frankly, it's within our power, the power of the American people, to turn everything around. Because if you look at the voting record of the rest of the world, the rest of the world stands on one side, and the United States and Israel on the other. Typical resolutions at the United Nations General Assembly calling, for example, for a two-state settlement. If you look at the voting record, a typical vote will be 160-4. The four dissenters will be the United States and Israel, and depending on which resolution we're talking about, it's going to be Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, and these three South Pacific atolls called Palu, Nauru, and Tuvalu. That's it. Palu, Nauru, Tuvalu, Micronesia, Marshall Islands, the United States and Israel on one side, the rest of the world on the other. And the challenge now is to get the United States on the side of the rest of the world.
Well, I agree with that. But I just think that the Israelis don't get it. They don't get that they're doing a very similar thing to the Palestinians that Hitler did to them.
Israelis do get it. I think we should, we should sort of try. First of all, I think there are many who do get it. And second of all, we have to, I think, always, look, I don't like what Israel's doing. I think what Israel's doing is really, it's criminal. There's no doubt in my mind about it. It's criminal by, international law standards. What they're committing is humanitarian crimes, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. Those are the legal distinctions. And if you read the reports of Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in Occupied Territories, it's called B'Tselem, if you look at their reports, they typically describe what Israel is doing, whether it's the demolition of homes, the bulldozing of homes, the torture of Palestinian detainees, the confiscation of land. They typically describe it as war crimes, breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention, war crimes or crimes against humanity. So there's no disputing the fact that they're engaging in what, by international standards of humanitarian and human rights law, constitute crimes. But we also have to always, I think, and keep in mind, or not be blinded to ourselves. So let me just give you a simple example. when Israel, during what was called Operation Defensive Shield in March and April 2002, when they went into the occupied territories, they went into Jenin, some of your listeners may recall, and they killed about, the estimate is about 59 or 61 people in Jenin. They then went into Nablus, and they killed about 70 people in Nablus. Now, that's terrible, no question about it. However, compared to what the U.S. does, when the U.S. went into Fallujah, it killed about 500 people. That's 10 times what happened in Jenin. It then went into Najaf, and the estimates are it killed 700 to 800 people. That's 10 times what was done in Nablus. Basically, what goes on is, you know, the amount of murder and mayhem that's inflicted is proportional to the amount of force you have at your disposal. And the United States has, you know, 10 times, and many more than 10, times the force at its disposal as Israel. And so the murder and mayhem it's inflicting on Iraq is on a scale of 10 times that of Israel.
We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left and some other callers, and I want to try to get at least one other in. We'll go next to Terre Haute and line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, my question is, I'd like his comment on the following. I'm in academia, so I know what he means by
everyone in academia knows.
Aggrandizement. And when you say enough with the Holocaust, I'm Gentile, and if I and I've thought that for years and years, and if I'd said that in any form, I would have been ridden out of the academic community quite easily. But what I wanted to ask your opinion on, or it seems to me that the emphasis on the Jewish Holocaust blocks out emphasis or knowledge of other Holocausts. And I refer specifically to the Soviet Holocaust. Now, it's believed by most scholars that 20 million people were killed by Stalin during the 30s and the 40s. And nobody seems to know that, but like you pointed out, everybody knows 6 million Jews were killed. So I'd like your comment on that. And also, how many people did the Turks kill in Armenia during the Armenian Holocaust? These are important facts. The Soviet Holocaust was way worse, and if I think that danger is worse than people like Hitler, that communism, socialism, is what was the cause of that. But I'd like your comments on that.
Well, I guess to begin with, we're on different sides of the ideological divide, but that shouldn't mean that we necessarily disagree on the facts, because you can be in different sides of the ideological divide because you interpret the facts differently, or you put them in a different, you organize them differently, but that doesn't mean the facts change because of ideology. I don't want to dispute your figures about Stalin. I don't think really any, I used to be a student of Soviet history. That was my field of expertise, but I stopped reading about it about 20 years ago, and so I haven't really followed the literature, and I don't know what the current figures are for the number, the current reliable figures for the numbers killed during the Stalin era. I would just say, as a point of, a point of moral principle, that the crimes we should be most concerned about are not the ones that are committed in the Soviet Union, heinous as they may be, and not the ones committed by the Nazis, heinous as they may be. But the morally responsible, I think, morally responsible position is to first be concerned about and privy to, knowledgeable of, the crimes committed by our own government, not just historically, but as we speak today. And I'm more concerned about how many young people know that, you know, the United States killed about 30,000 Nicaraguans during the so-called Contra War in the 19, 1980s, that about 100,000 Guatemalan Mayans were killed in the genocide between 1954 and 1990 in a succession of U.S.-backed regimes. And to go on and on, I think it's more important that we know those facts about our government, our history, before we learn about other people and other governments. In the same way, it certainly is morally appropriate that we should have had under Washington, or whatever they call it there, we should have had a museum acknowledging the extermination of Native Americans and the enslavement of African Americans before we had a museum of the Nazi Holocaust, for reasons which are, you know, perfectly obvious to anyone in a moment's reflection. What would we think if Germany had erected a museum in Berlin to commemorate the extermination of the Native Americans? They had no museum to commemorate the extermination of the Jews. We would think, my God, what hypocrites. Well, isn't it the same sort of hypocrisy when we have a museum to commemorate the crimes that Germany committed, but none to commemorate the crimes that we committed?
We're going to have to stop here, and my apologies. We have some people we can't take, but we've simply exhausted our time. People who are interested in reading more of the thoughts of our guest, Norman Finkelstein, certainly can go and seek out his books, and in particular the most recent, The Holocaust Industry. It's now available in paperback. Norman Finkelstein is professor of political science at DePaul University. And Professor Finkelstein, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Programming also made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the afternoon magazine, conversation about the American West and the Rocky Mountains. This is an archive interview about the place that they hold in our history and in our imagination. An interview with naturalist and writer Gary Ferguson. His latest book is titled The Great Divide, The Rocky Mountains and the American Mind. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. Celeste Quinn back as host. The show gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports right here on AM 580. Coming up in the next hour of this show, we'll be talking with poet Bob Hickok. He now teaches creative writing at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia, has published a number of collections of his poetry, has got a lot of favorable attention and won a number of awards. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be doing a reading later on today. And here in the studio with us, I'm sure, we'll read some of his work, talk a little bit about his writing. His most recent collection is titled Insomnia Diary. So that will be coming up in the next part of Focus 580. Hope you'll stay tuned. We'll have some news at 1 minute past the hour from National Public Radio. Before that, an update on the commodity market. So please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. Chicago Board of Trade corn futures are modestly higher at midday, staging a minor